I don't need no doctor. D'Anthony could have been a character in one of the Godfather movies. Born in the Bronx as Anthony D'Addario, he was Italian through and through. I met him in the fall of 1971. He was in his late 40s, short and heavyset, with salt and pepper hair and a full beard. D got in the music business through his boyhood friend Jerry Vale. After a few years, he was managing Tony Bennett. Then in the late 60s, he switched his focus to rock and roll. Joe Cocker, 10 Years After, and Jethro Tull were just some of the groups that had been involved with D. At the time I met him, he was managing Humble Pie, the Jay Giles Band, and Peter Frampton. He also looked after Emerson, Lake & Palmer in the United States. D was very knowledgeable, well-respected, and rumored to be connected. Whether he was or not didn't really matter. He was like the godfather to his groups, and they seemed to enjoy treating him that way. My father and uncle owned a trucking and warehousing company, the Teamsters, a notoriously Italian union, if you know what I mean, drove the trucks and managed the warehouse. Growing up, I liked to go to work with my father. I hung out in the warehouse or on the loading docks, and the guys that worked for him became like Dutch uncles to me. Dee and I hit it off immediately. He hired me on the spot. I didn't have an actual job title. I was Dee's special assistant. He spent hours explaining the ins and outs of the business as only he could. Very early on, he pounded one fact into my brain. Neil, this is the most important lesson I can teach you. Number one, get the money. Number two, remember to get the money. And number three, don't forget to always remember to get the money. Frank Barcelona was the head of Premier Talent, rock and roll's foremost booking agency. Dee and Frank were particularly close and spent many hours together. It was an honor to be included in their discussions. In 2005, Frank was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because of his unparalleled contributions to the development of the rock and roll industry. To this day, he's the only agent ever inducted. He had the vision to get acts, promoters, and record companies to work together. As Bono said, without the belief of people like Frank, no one would have ever known about Led Zeppelin, The Stones, or U2. Dee's groups were doing well. Humble Pie's album, Rockin' the Fillmore, was rising up the charts. A few months later, when the boys in the band gave him a Silver Cloud Rolls Royce as a thank you, he looked at me and said, "See? Stick with me. You'll have a few of these by the time you get to be my age." Our relationship was close. Dee had a daughter, but he didn't have a son. That bode well for me, but there was one problem. His younger brother and partner, Bill. The only thing I will say about Bill was that he always had the best-looking dry-clean jeans and a year-round golden brown tan. Bill and I got along very well, but in the back of my mind, I knew that I could only go so far. I was living in a duplex apartment on Barrow Street in the West Village section of New York City. Stu and Laura Woods lived next door. Stu Woods was a very popular bass player. He played on albums by Dylan, Al Kooper, Bette Midler, and Todd Rundgren. I met him during the final days of his band Brethren, made up of Stu, Rick Murata, Tommy Cosgrove, and Mike Garson. They were all great musicians. Each went on to have an impressive career in the studio, playing with everyone from David Bowie to Steely Dan to Aretha Franklin and Carly Simon. Stu started to work with Janis Ian. Her song, Society's Child, about a forbidden interracial romance, had been a very controversial hit in the late 60s. She hadn't done much since, and she was considered by many a one-hit wonder. That was to change a few years later with the release of the single At 17. The song propelled her to number one on the Adult Contemporary charts. Stu played that song with her at the Grammys in 1975, the same year she won the award for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance. I spent a lot of time in Stu's apartment. He had an interesting circle of friends, including Todd Rundgren and Moogie Klingman. Moogie was a successful musician and songwriter. He was the original keyboardist for Todd Rundgren's band Utopia. Later on, he became Bette Midler's musical director and co-wrote You Gotta Have Friends, a song she made famous. He was a frequent visitor to Stu's apartment. I liked Moogie, but he was a bit of a space cadet. One day, he asked me to do him a favor. He didn't have a car, and he needed to take a keyboard to a studio uptown. I told him it wouldn't fit in my trunk. He insisted we try anyway. Sure enough, it didn't fit. Moogie ran upstairs to Stu's apartment and got some flimsy rope. I didn't like the way it looked. He was in a hurry. Don't worry, it'll be okay, he assured me. 3 blocks later, the keyboard came loose and fell out of the trunk. The worst part was that the rope stayed attached. I had dragged it 50 feet before Moogie realized and started yelling, Stop! He was supposed to have been watching. We got it there in one piece, but it looked pretty trashed. Moogie was not a happy camper. Dee started me on the road with Humble Pie. I went on some East Coast dates. Steve Marriott was a brilliant singer who had been with the Small Faces. Peter Frampton was no longer in the band. Didn't seem to matter to the audience. They usually closed the set with a Ray Charles cover called I Don't Need No Doctor. It was released as a single and became a minor hit on FM radio. I loved the way they did that song, but I loved the title even more. In March of 1972, Dee sent me out on the ELP US tour. Emerson, Lake & Palmer had released Tarkus, their second album, about a year before. They were preparing for their next album, Trilogy, which would be released sometime that summer. ELP were big time and very important to Dee. My primary job was to do box office, collect the money. Groups were paid a guarantee up front, with a percentage of the gate to be paid in cash at the concert. In the days before computers, no one used bank transfers, and trust between parties was limited. Someone representing the group would physically go to the box office during the show and count ticket stubs. As the road manager with Edgar Winter, it was part of my job. ELP had a road manager, but he had his hands full with a large crew and elaborate staging. When Dee suggested that I go on the tour, even though it was an additional expense, the band was more than agreeable. Of course, Dee had a hidden agenda. He didn't want to go on the whole tour. I could be his eyes and ears when he wasn't there. I had seen ELP when Edgar opened for them. They were like something from outer space. Keith Emerson came on stage all in leather. He wore tight silver-gray pants and a spaceman-like short silver jacket with very exaggerated shoulders. Knee-high black leather boots with heavy silver buckles completed the outfit. The centerpiece of his rig was the Moog synthesizer, a very large piece of electronics with many crossed wires and flashing colored lights. It stood above his Hammond B3 organ. Carl Palmer had an enormous stainless steel drum set, flanked by two huge oriental gongs. Behind Greg sat stacks of amplifiers. Needless to say, I was impressed. I didn't see much of their set, but what I did see had left quite an impression. I was psyched. I hadn't been on a major tour with an A-list rock and roll group. I was mostly going to meetings and working in the office. I missed touring. ELP were big-time headliners. I couldn't wait for the Learjets, limos, and five-star hotels, not to mention the groupies and the parties every night.